This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The job title sounds simple enough. Emergency Relief Coordinator for the UN. The responsibilities that come with it, not so simple. Sisyphus comes to mind. But here's a resume that might pop out. Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs for 3 years, Secretary General of the Norwegian Red Cross, UN Special Advisor on Colombia, former radio and TV reporter. Jan Egeland also formed a chapter of Amnesty International at the age of 15 and went on to serve as vice chair of Amnesty's International Executive Committee. In his most recent job, Egeland chided the world's richest governments as stingy with foreign aid and then humbly thanked them for the helicopters they loaned that carried critical supplies into remote areas. He worked on the world's most intractable conflicts, Darfur, Congo, Chad, and Somalia, on the South Asian tsunami and the massive earthquake in Pakistan, and on perhaps his darkest day, 21 of his colleagues were killed in Iraq when a truck bomb exploded at the UN headquarters in Baghdad. Later on in the program, the seductive power of smoking in the movies. Anybody got a match? But first, a conversation with Jan Egeland. If you have questions for him about what he's learned from all these conflicts and disasters, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Jan Egeland joins us today from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And I understand that when you left the UN last December, you said you wanted to go back to Norway to spend more time with your family, yet here you are again.
Yeah, I have been asked by the new Secretary General to work part-time as his special advisor on conflict resolution, preventing war, helping to set up mediation groups and so on. And I am I'm very pleased to be able to do that part-time and at the same time spend much more time with my family in Oslo, Norway.
Well, that sounds like a compromise that might be acceptable to your family as well. I assume much of the past 3 years you didn't get a chance to see very much of them.
No, it was the toughest 3.5 years of my life. I traveled some 200 days per year. I worked all weekends, most holidays, because the world doesn't stop in terms of disasters, in terms of war, and our opportunities to help do not stop. So we have a golden opportunity to stop war, massive suffering, if we use our resources well.
Mm-hmm. As you look back on it, obviously there must have been many disappointments. Was there a moment of satisfaction when you said to yourself, you know, maybe today I made a difference?
Oh, yeah, there were many, many such days. Actually, the majority of the days I went from the office feeling that, well, we've gotten convoys through, we've raised more money, we've saved many lives, we've become more effective, we've organized ourselves better. In the tsunami, we had a remarkable international response. So in the devastating earthquake in Pakistan. In Darfur, it was a mixed picture in the sense that my humanitarian colleagues that I helped to coordinate saved hundreds of thousands of lives that were predicted to get lost at the same time as the world failed politically and security-wise in protecting the people that we fed and sheltered.
Yet, I don't see that that's changed a great deal in the 6 months since you left.
No, it's the same or worse in terms of this paradox that we are too often providing a plaster on the wound, a very good-looking plaster, but we're not healing the wound. And it is immoral in many ways that we, in the safe areas of Bosnia, up until Srebrenica, now in Darfur, in many other places, do not have world leaders come together and say, enough is enough, we have to protect the people and we have to enforce peace and ceasefire. It's not enough with blankets and food alone.
Mm. We want to get listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, Jan Egeland is our guest. He's at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's begin with the phone call from Peter. Peter's with us from Minneapolis.
Yeah, I had a question regarding donor fatigue, and I want to use that broadly. I understand the relative difference between different countries and the amount they donate, and certainly North America being a little bit less than Europe. But it seems that there's a whole lot more going on in the world now than there was in the 80s or even the early 90s, and I'm wondering to what extent do not just people but governments become more blasé, although they may not admit it, to some of the crises going on. And then as a follow-up, I'm curious if there's any, if you've noticed any relationship between a country's tendency to take people through immigration as refugees versus the amount they donate, or if actually it's kind of the reverse. I have a number of friends in Scandinavia, and it seems that they're a bit more restrictive on the immigration, but of course they're by far donate the most in terms of per capita to a lot of areas. I'll take my question on the air then.
Okay, Peter, thanks for the call.
No, I think you're right, Peter. Also in your last observation, I indeed, and Norway is at the moment, together with Sweden and perhaps the Netherlands, the only countries in the world that is reaching 1% of gross national income in foreign assistance. But truly, I have found my own country and others very restrictive in terms of immigration. The United States has been much more open in terms of immigration. So there's no, whereas Sweden, our neighbor, also has been more open. I think some of the small, very homogeneous societies do not like immigration. In terms of of generosity, well, the picture is also mixed. There is there has been some more aid dollars most years in a row. Actually, 2006 saw a very sad decline compared to 2005. There were just figures coming out of the OECD, which I'm monitoring this these days. What's very sad is to register that this came after the G8 leaders in Gleneagles during the British chairmanship said that they would dramatically increase investment up to $50 billion a year by 2010. It was a huge commitment by the US president, by the British prime minister, by the Japanese prime minister, etc., etc. And none of them have, except for Britain, followed up to reach this this target. And my famous comment of the taken in the spur of the moment at the press conference of the stinginess of the rich country is actually related to the fact that on average, rich countries now give 0.2% of their riches, at best, as an average. In other words, keeping 99.8% to themselves in a time when you've never been richer. In my view, if you get richer, it should be easier to give a little bit more of your share to those who have nothing. But it seems to be other, you know, different. From Norway, it's very hard to reach that 1% every year because the gross national income is growing so much. It should be very easy, in my view, when it is growing so much.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is going to be Simon. Simon with us from Sharon in Vermont.
Hi, I'm calling because, and thank you for taking my call. It seems to be that those countries who receive, during a disaster, who receive media attention for whatever reason, those are the disasters. Those are the countries that get support, and that was certainly the case with the tsunami, to some extent with the Pakistan earthquake in 2005. But it's very much, it seems, and Mr. Eglin has been very good to note, that it's certainly a lottery of who gets assistance and who does not. I understand that certain measures have been taken, like the Central Emergency Response Fund, to support those forgotten and neglected disasters, but how can we continue to raise real money, real awareness, for those situations which might not get CNN and the other networks covering them?
And let me broaden, if you don't mind, Simon, broaden out the question to ask. One of the things you've also pointed out, Mr. Eglin, is that a lot of this money might be better spent in development rather than responding to crises. And if the places were properly developed, if there was, for example, good, well-built structures that would greatly reduce the damage done by earthquakes and tsunamis.
No, indeed. And again, back to the famous Stingy comment was actually on a direct question on could it have been prevented, all of this? And I said, yes, with early warning systems, the people would not have had to die as massively as they did. And they, with better hurricane-resistant buildings, nobody can build, against tsunamis alone. If they had had better building standards, many, many more houses would have also sustained all of this. So, our generosity is usually linked to us knowing that something dramatic is happening and knowing that the media will, except a few internationally oriented ones, and actually CNN International, BBC International are following very well the world. NPR is following well the world, but the mainstream media, they follow one to two crises at a time. And for the last few years, it's been Iraq and to some extent the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that's full stop. I remember looking at the figures which showed that when millions of people were dying in the Congo, there were 1,000 times more coverage of the Michael Jackson case in North America than Congo. And it was the biggest loss of human life on our watch these last year, 4 million people.
Simon, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking today with Jan Eglin. He's the former United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator and the editor of the Director of Humanitarian Affairs. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Jan Eglin. He's the former Emergency Relief Coordinator for the United Nations. In that capacity, he's visited some of the most stricken areas on Earth, earthquake-shaken, war-torn, from Darfur to Pakistan. If you have questions about what he's learned from all these conflicts and disasters, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. Let's get a caller in. Nathaniel with us from Detroit.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Great. So my questions are personal, not political. Okay, you go into these areas and you see what's going on, I don't know if it's on a daily basis and over again. How do you deal with that? And the people who work there are working out in the disasters.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question because indeed you see enormous degree of misery. For me, it was not so difficult to be there at the time. When I came, it was to plan more action. It was to plan how we could appeal for more resources. I often joined convoys bringing in more assistance and so on. I felt always it was very difficult to travel from there. Because when we went into our cars or into our airplane that would take us or helicopter take us out of the situation, I knew I would be flying back to Manhattan, New York, where I would be safe and well cared for in my office and with my family, and they would be left behind. Today, we are discussing we're seeing in the media how, for the third day in a row, some Palestinian refugees are caught in the crossfire in the Lebanon
and
into those camps.
And indeed, a UN relief convoy got caught in the crossfire today.
Caught in the crossfire, and our colleagues had to withdraw. They couldn't bring the food and the water and the medical supplies. Those camps are just heartbreaking because in many of them, people have been refugees since they left Israel in 1948. I mean, since they're parents or grandparents are left, they are utterly crowded. And then people say, why don't they just leave and integrate into Lebanon or go to Europe or the United States? The answer is they cannot. They're not allowed, in most cases, to leave from the camp. They have no other life. That's what has produced so much bitterness and extremism. And yes, leaving such camps has always been terrible. The ICE will follow you when you when you fall asleep.
Yes, there were. You were also, as a Norwegian diplomat, instrumental in the negotiations that led to the Oslo Accord. And this is a conflict that's been through so many ups and downs. And there must have been a moment back in the 90s when you said, "Aha, real progress. This might be a real solution."
Yes, unashamedly, we thought we had embarked on the road to a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in 1993. I was there when we signed the Oslo Agreement in secrecy. We were 20 people present, including the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the Norwegian small group of facilitators. I was there when Bill Clinton, you know, was matchmaker for the famous handshake at the White House lawn. We thought it was the end of it, but we had underestimated the counter forces, the terror, the violence that erupted on both sides. But I also take a lot of heart in the fact that the world is getting better, undoubtedly better. There are more situations getting better than getting worse. Those who are getting worse has been the Palestinian situation, Iraq of late, Darfur of late.
Get another caller on the line. This is Anne with us from Worcester, Massachusetts.
Hi, I'm on a cell phone, so I apologize if we get cut off. I want to make a statement and then ask a related question about strategy. I'm an ordinary citizen. I've been somewhat active. I've written letters to congressmen, to the president, to the United Nations. I've disinvested from funds that are investing in companies that do business in Darfur. It seems to have no effect, and it becomes really discouraging to continue to do more. In fact, I've written a letter to SaveDarfur.org saying, you know, I cannot continue to do the same ineffective things. My question may be naive, but here it is. Does it make sense to consider a policy of beginning to resettle people out of the region, given that there appears not to be the political will on the part of world leaders to intervene to protect these people in their own country? And I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
And thanks for the call.
Well, first of all, don't become discouraged, because we really need you and others to stay on and stay the course on Darfur. What's happened in North America and the United States is a very impressive coalition, which is bipartisan, which are faith-based. It's solidarity groups, it's student groups, everybody working together. Darfur will also get better, but it's going too slow. One of the already people have left in 200,000 to 300,000 have, as you know, fled from Darfur. They are now in Chad. They do not have a much better life in the desert in Chad than they have in Darfur. Could they have gone to other countries? Well, then you would have had such an ambitious resettlement program, because it's 2 to 3 million people who are now really caught in this conflict. What we have to do is fix it where it is. One of the lessons I've learned is that the coalition of countries pushing for the right thing in Sudan was too Western and was too Northern, really. The policies of the United States and the United Kingdom and of European Union was generally very good. But they were not very influential. Those who could have been very influential to start with was China, India, Malaysia, Pakistan, and the Arab countries. Mm. And we should have much earlier pushed them and said, well, China, India, you're the biggest economic partners to Sudan. what are you planning to do? What is your solution? Because the situation is absolutely desperate and it's deteriorating.
Let me ask you another question. This is an email from David. What constitutes a crisis and how do you decide which crisis to assist? Zimbabwe is going through huge issues at the moment. Why is the UN not helping them?
We are very active in Zimbabwe. I went there myself. I called it the meltdown when I came out, and I got scolded publicly by President Mugabe for that. Zimbabwe is perhaps the country with the sharpest decline in standards of living. Average life expectancy was more than 60 years just 15 years ago. Now it is 34 years. We have a very major program, and we are distributing food to hundreds of thousands. At the maximum, it was, I think, more than 2 million people who got food in Zimbabwe. But the government has to change its policies if we're able to fix the situation. Mm. What's a crisis? Well, there are many thresholds that we are defining. Basically, where there are major needs, we are there as a UN system, as a humanitarian system, US NGOs, Red Cross, and so on. What we call a crisis is usually defined by mortality. And if more than 1,000 per 10,000 people die per day, we call it an emergency. And in Darfur, it was in the summer of 2004, more than two who died every day. But in northern Uganda and Somalia, that's also been the level for too many years, really.
You talked about some of the frustrations of political effects. Obviously, that weighs in a situation like Zimbabwe as well, where the most powerful neighbor, South Africa, does not see the situation the way others see it.
No, indeed. It's like, at times I feel like, you know, the various countries of the UN specialize in trying to solve the situations where they are uniquely disqualified from really making a difference. And of course, the black African countries have to do more in Zimbabwe. Britain has no sort of moral authority in Zimbabwe because of apartheid and Rhodesia. Mm-hmm. It is not so easy for the United States to tell the Arab radical regimes after Iraq, you know, you really have to behave because there's a lot of violence in Darfur. You have to have Arab countries to see what's really happening there. And then the United States could perhaps have done more consistently, put pressure on in the Israeli-Palestinian situation, where the U.S. is uniquely qualified to help much more than perhaps any other in the world.
Let's get Bridge on the line. Or Brig, is it, in Seattle?
Yes. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is in dealing with the great injustices that these humanitarian crises bring about, how do you, what's the line in pragmatically solving these crises? Is it, how much do you call upon, you know, might makes right and in enforcing, you know, right relationship in the areas of injustice? And how much do you rely on nonviolent means to try to affect change in these regions?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we try to do in the United Nations is to use a multiplicity of tools in each situation. It's the strength of the United Nations. It's also our inbuilt problem in a way that we are so diverse. But the only way you can get Afghanistan on its right feet is by having humanitarian, developmental, security, political, you know, good governance, etc., efforts go in parallel. If it's only military, it will not, or secure, it will not, it will fail. If it's only humanitarian, it will fail. Darfur is really too much humanitarian and too little of everything else. in Afghanistan, it has perhaps been too much military and too little development and so on. And the country is so poor that it gives it's very easy to get new insurgencies and new extremism there. There has to be many things at the same time. You also mentioned justice. People have to be brought to justice if they have, as leaders, been responsible for genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes. If there is impunity, the wound just gets more and more infected.
Thanks for the call, Brig.
Thank you so much.
We're talking with Jan Egeland, the former UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, now Special Advisor to the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on conflict resolution. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's a quick email question from William in Wiesbaden in Germany. When calculating aid from individual countries, is private charity taken into account, or are you just looking at government numbers?
Now, when we look at these percentages of gross national income, it's government money. Usually, it's not that different if you bring in private money. I mean, some of those who are highest on the list in government money also top private money. But certainly, for example, from the United States, there are large sums from the private sector, and so from many European countries. The problem with the private money is, as we already noted, it's going a little bit too much to those disasters that get a lot of attention. The government money can balance out that, and we have now a central emergency relief fund set up in my time precisely to jumpstart operations when there is no money, and for the forgotten and neglected emergencies, Central African Republic, Guinea-Bissau, even Zimbabwe, that get too little attention.
You were talking very optimistically about how things have improved. Let me ask you this by way of an email, a situation which seems like one of those intractable ones. This email from Luis in Miami Beach. Please ask your guest to offer his thoughts over the humanitarian tragedy in Colombia and the apparent complicity of the government there with paramilitary forces. If the USA support of plan for Colombia hampering or aiding in this troubled region.
I know Colombia very well. I traveled there when I was 19 the first time, and that is exactly 30 years ago, and I've been there regularly since. Colombia has the biggest war of the Western Hemisphere, the biggest human rights problem of the Western Hemisphere, the biggest refugee problem, the biggest humanitarian problem, the biggest drug problem, and it needs more attention, really. And it is, to me, interesting that there is not more focus in North America for what is happening in places like Colombia and Bolivia and whatnot, where there is conflict or conflict is threatening. Plan Colombia is a multiplicity of things. It's funded by the United States, and it is here there are very different views on its effect, but there are certainly good elements, and there are elements that are controversial there. The government has been able to decrease violence in the cities, so it's much safer now than before in Colombia to be a middle-class person in the towns and the cities, but it is still terrible what's happening in the countryside. And perhaps for me, one of the indicators that I have often tried to get interest in is that too many Indian tribes are now struggling to not become extinct. Yes. Because of having been caught in the crossfire of the war and are being driven away by drug lords and others from their ancestral lands.
We just have a few seconds left with you in your new role as a part-timer. What's the first opportunity you're going to take on?
Well, I'm now participating in doing two things here. One is to put up something similar to what we have on the humanitarian side, namely standby arrangements where we can go easily with relief workers, but in this case for peace mediators, for mm-hmm. conflict resolution people, for people who can advise and how to reach agreements instead of going for conflict. And secondly, we're going strategically, conflict by conflict, looking at what have we done wrong as United Nations, what can we do better, how can we really do more, and then I'm also going to do some field visits to assess.
Jan Egeland,
I'm excited about this.
We all universally wish you the best of luck.
For having me today.
Jan Egeland, former Undersecretary General. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.